1889, both feeling under the weather and wondering what this phrase means. Yes. And Isaiah is wearing an extremely long, splendid blue bathrobe.
No, it's a dressing gown.
A dressing gown, excuse me.
Not a bathrobe, it was in
brown moccasins on his feet.
Oh, the school of the tribe in Haiti. I was inside a schoolboy.
Yes.
Yes.
Very good. Very good vintage. And I wanted to talk to you last time.
But my love affairs you were talking about.
Aren't you clever?
That's what you said.
Yes, absolutely right.
Yes, well, no.
Because we talked very...
You were talking about another subject. You were talking about equally embarrassing. Is my social life.
Yes. Well, we can talk about both.
It's a topic.
Yes, it's a topic.
I mean, there was none that existed at a certain point. Then it's suddenly burst into bloom. Yes. Then it was it again.
Yes. We've had a rather... We've got ourselves to 1938.
Yes.
And I haven't asked you a single question about your interest in the opposite sex.
No, we haven't.
Or in the same sex, or other sex, or any sex.
By 1938, it's hardly well, indeed. Yes, it's presented a portal of it. I don't think I was never, certainly in my childhood, that I didn't feel drawn to boys or girls in any sense. Will this mission record it?
Yes.
Yeah, my
well, every deathless word.
Not too long, yes. At school, I suppose, I think I must have been in love with a boy, although I don't think it crossed my mind that we were, felt some kind of, he certainly didn't respond particularly, nothing happened.
Yes.
I didn't touch him.
What do you remember about him? Who was
that
he?
I was really loved seeing him, was somehow rather fascinated by his appearance. He became a clergyman afterwards.
Yeah.
His name was Corin. He became a clergyman, and I remember when I was a don, I saw he was preaching at St. Paul's. So I thought I'd go and look, and what it all turned out to be like. I was at school with him from 22 to 28. He was preaching, I think, in maybe 47, 48, 49, after the war.
Yeah.
I went and looked. Large, fat, very unattractive looking man. Appeared in the pulpit, preached a not very interesting sermon.
Yes.
That's all there. I just wondered, out of pure curiosity.
Yes. But what was it about him as a little boy? He was fresh-cheeked and sweet. And,
no, he wasn't fresh-cheeked, he was musical and imaginative and a great charm.
Yeah.
And it's quite obvious that I did have some kind of physical feeling crush.
Yeah.
But that's all that could be said. Yeah. We used to go to concerts at Queen's Hall together. And on Sunday, on Saturday afternoons, and got on very well. But I don't think he felt, we were great friends, I don't think he felt the slightest emotion that came on my part.
Well, you never know.
Well, I don't think there's much evidence of it. He might have said something at some point, to somebody. Then I went up to Oxford, you see, after I had no more homosexual feelings. Opposite sex, you call them. Yes, wait a minute. Nothing. I assumed that I had no interest in them at all. My assumption was that I was frightfully unattractive, in appearance in every other way, and that I had no, nothing would happen in that direction. I made up my mind about that quite early. I didn't make it as a decision, it was a statement of fact.
Yes.
That I was obviously outside of the and they wouldn't look at me, and I didn't terribly, felt no violent attraction, and I just assumed I was going to be a bachelor forever.
Yes.
Quite quietly, I didn't think it was a tremendous decision, it was something very exceptional. There were plenty of bachelor dons in Oxford these days, it was exceptional, and now there it was. Now, when did I feel my first stirrings? No, as a schoolboy, it's true. As a schoolboy, towards the end of my school life, I'm wrong, yes, about 1927. Then about, so I was 18, I did feel attracted by a girl called Ruth Baker, who was the daughter of friends of my parents called Baker. And when we used to meet, I was charmed by her looks, and obviously I wanted to be in her presence, wanted to talk to her. Came to nothing with it.
Yeah.
Never developed anyway. And I knew that other people my age did have, if not affairs, anyhow, some kind of relationships.
Yeah.
But it obviously didn't affect me. As an undergraduate in Oxford, nothing at all. Neither men nor women.
And there weren't that many women about?
Well, there were. If one wanted, there were.
Yeah.
Oh, it was Lady Longford, Elizabeth Pagenham,
yeah.
Who was an absolute Zuleika Dobson. She was a famous beauty, photographs in every window. She went about both with football blues and these seats. And first time that she broke through the barrier, which on the whole assumed that undergraduates were frumps, and the upper classes when they wanted women brought them down to London.
Yeah.
She was the first person who broke through the barrier of assumption that female undergraduates are of no possible interest to anyone. And that's probably why, no. But I mean, if we say there were no women, there were some. Yes, among people I knew, there were, I mean, people flirted with, but nothing to me. I just assumed that it's outside my range. It wasn't a question of that I felt anything or not. I behaved like a red Indian in society of whites, which is a different tribe.
Yes.
In that respect, I mean, I just assumed there's no one.
I do find that puzzling. Here you are, a charming fellow, even at that age, obviously a good talker,
fat,
with a great capacity
fat
for...
Fat and rather ugly.
It's ugliness, it's a feeling...
Well, I'm just fat, too. I was a monster, I was frightfully fat. Much more so than now. Fat and ungainly, rather, I thought. Any obvious of no, I didn't assume that I was. I made no effort. Any kind. But wait. Now. We now reach my young... Dawn period. I go to All Souls in 1932. I remember meeting in 1933 at lunch a lady who is now called Mrs. Hart, the wife of Herbert Hart, who was called Jennifer Fish Williams, who was a famous beauty in her day. I felt nothing at all. Later, I fell in love with her. But that's for later. Yes, but that was well, we're not over 1950, but this is 32. In 1936, I had a pupil. Do you want me to mention names? I didn't say why not.
Why not?
Because I'll remain private and so on.
Yes.
I had a pupil, wanted to be taught philosophy by me, called Rachel Walker. Her sister was married to the chaplain of Christchurch, later became Bishop of Exeter, and her nephew is called Edward Mortimer, who writes about Arabs, famous Arabists and so on.
Yeah.
This is his aunt. She fell madly in love with me, in a lunatic way, and began to write me love letters, which excited me greatly, and I thought, because I was no good and no use, I tried to kill. So she was, but I got rid of her as a pupil rather quickly. I thought I mustn't do that. Sent off to be taught by Freddy Eyre, although she didn't get on at all. Although he was a very promiscuous figure.
Yeah.
Even then, flirted with everybody.
Yeah.
Said Don Juan figure.
Yeah.
Well, I was married, but that didn't work. So she repelled her, or she was repelled by him. But then, and I remember she then, one evening when I came, back to All Souls at about 11 o'clock after some philosophy meeting, she was sitting in my room, to my astonishment. And there she was trembling with some kind of emotion. Well, we spent the night in my room, nothing ever happened. She sat on the sofa, I sat in an armchair, and then I smuggled her out of the cottage fairly early in the morning.
Yeah.
And I was not allowed to have women
in
All Souls, but I could see. And then I went to Paris to visit her. Because I became very excited by the stage. I wondered if I was in love. Because her passion was so great that it infected me to some extent.
Yes.
And therefore created some kind of counter feeling. She plainly wanted to marry me. That was obvious. She didn't just want an affair. We had no affair.
Yeah.
But she, the whole thing was a little too intense.
Yes.
And a little mystical. She was a highbrow girl. She studied logic in Paris. She was fallen in love with by the principal young logician of the period, who was later killed in a German concentration camp, who was a descendant of Henri IV, who who is really jealous of him. And Kavayets, is his name? Mm-hmm. Who told her, yes.
Sorry, say that again?
Kavayets.
Kavayets.
C-A-V-I, C-A-V-I, double L-E-S.
Yes.
Looks so great.
Yes, yes.
Kavayets. Who learned logic in Germany. Don't read this album. They call normal. In fact. But I remember going back and flew to Paris, the North Sierra Toll. Show that I was in some condition of emotional excitement.
Yes.
That's undeniable.
Yes.
But as I say, nothing happened. And finally, when I realized I would have to do something, I said, no, I can't. It's no good. And then we were not made for each other. I did a sort of, in yes and I do. Thing which I had to do later in life. And she was very distressed by this, and she kept making confessions to her friend, Julia Packer was her best friend. She's a sister of President Lord Longford, but she died quite a long time ago, very nice girl, the counselor I. And who used to come see me and say, look, for Dips, which is what she was called, this is really in the state, you know, I mean, Mr. Count, you really, do you feel nothing for him? Look, I mean, he's so passionate. Surely he'd be very happy. He loves you so much. Couldn't you? Can't you? Shouldn't you? Well, I held out. And then she went off ahead. And he's still alive in a state of presumed schizophrenia. Uh-huh. I don't think she's dead. She's been in Lunabin, as far as I know, ever since. We planted a field of guilt in me, as you can imagine.
Gracious.
Because I was obviously, in some sense, the cause, maybe only the occasion.
Yes.
But certainly not totally relevant.
Yes.
Situation. She suddenly went mad, didn't talk about this, developed a certain hatred for me.
Yes.
She had to write me a violent letter, and I was locked up for the war.
Locked up by whom? By her family?
By her family, yes. And,
did you ever see her again?
No, no, never.
You had no further contact?
I thought better what I thought, better not. I thought it might aggravate.
Yes. And you had no further contact with her?
None at all. I used to hear about her from my friends.
Yes.
Who didn't blame me particularly. Realize that this was, it to be passion for me. It's probably the beginning of lunacy.
Yes.
Couldn't be regarded as entirely.
Yes.
I think they thought perhaps, almost I couldn't be regarded as entirely innocent. But still, nobody blamed me.
Yes.
Anything I'd done, they didn't lure her on anyway. They didn't betray her in any describable sense of the word.
Yes.
Her friend, she had one great friend who was a ex-head of St. Hilda's College in Oxford, it's called Mary Fisher, who was the daughter of H.L. Fisher, who was born in New College,
the famous historian. Yes.
And she became a married man and became, you know, because she's about to in Oxford.
Yes.
Because I see her from time to time. That's one of our friends. The girl called Phoebe Poole came into the news because she was writing something about she'd been mistress to Bill Kilstrey, the painter, many years.
Yes.
And was discovered to be a communist agent long after her death. There's a story in the papers about Anthony Blunt.
Right.
I don't know if you remember.
No.
Well, I won't waste too much of your time. The point was that this girl called Phoebe Poole was very sweet and holy and extremely highbrow, very gentle and very, very sort of spiritual in character. We all liked because she was very sensitive, read books, said interesting things about them.
Yeah.
Was much adored. She was sort of icon.
Yeah.
Well, a lot of girls.
Yeah.
Some degree of lesbianism, I think, get. In the world of sorts. She worked in the quarter, and then herself went overhead. And that novelist woman, what's her name?
Oh, Anita Bruckner, yes, Anita now Bruckner. It all comes back to me. Yes.
Remember the story?
Yes.
She was sent by Blunt to see her in the hospital, and then she would say, did she say anything?
Yes.
And she then realized that she was being sent as an aide to somebody. He was afraid she might talk.
Yeah.
She was a courier for the party, basically. You see, she was being used by Blunt.
Yes.
She was a great friend, but she thought she was looking out this saintly lady.
Yes.
Well, in a sense she was, but he had a motive.
Yes.
Supposedly he was writing a book on Picasso with her.
Yes, I remember.
And she was outraged by being made use of by this. She adored Blunt, and the thoughts he never told her that he was using as his girl out of the way.
Yeah.
Upset her. Well, that's, she was a great friend of mine. Lady Rachel Walker, Tips. Tips, as she was normally known. And that has been recorded, but I wasn't in love.
Yeah.
I was, in some way, I mean, obviously, affected.
Yeah.
And wondered if, I mean, I contemplated the possibility of marrying her.
Yeah.
But because the passion that's ever so strong that it's had on, it had an electric effect. So it's just sane enough.
Yeah.
To realize it was no good.
Yeah. That's 36. And then what happens?
That is 36, 37, 38. That goes over some time.
Oh, all right.
Then comes the war. Then I go to New York. In New York, another girl displays the same symptoms. She was a Jewish girl from Palestine, whose parents lived in Riga and knew my parents. So my aunt gave her a letter to me, and she came to see me. She was very pretty, and she was called Miss Averbuch.
Averbuch,
which must be corrupt from Auerbach.
Yeah.
I think all these are. There's a man called Auerbach, who was the head of RAP, if you remember, the Communist Literary Organization, who was afterwards liquidated.
Yeah.
I mean, there was a famous sort of tyrannous, despotic communist literary body who believed in writing squads of writers, you know, collective writing about communist themes, RAP, R-A-W-P, I can't remember what it's called, something must be Rabochik, I don't know, Rabochik or something. Proletarsky Pisatsiri. Proletarsky Pisatsiri.
Yeah, we got something, the two P's. Yeah.
Two P's we have, yes. What R-A stands for, I can't think. Revolution there. Well, he was called Averbuch. It's the same
and
name.
She was
Averbuch.
Yes, she was Averbuch.
Yes, but it's...
And what was her first name?
That I can't remember. She may be alive.
1940.
This is 1941.
Yeah.
1941, I'm in New York. And she produced a letter, and I must have had a cup of coffee with her or something. And she was very pretty and not hysterical. Fair-haired, blue-eyed, absolutely charming in a way. And it's clear to me after first fortnight she developed a crush on me.
Yeah.
Well, that's just pure nuisance. I was upset by that, I thought, God.
You don't want
to. Well, she was hysterical. She was obviously, I mean, state of constant.
Yeah.
My aunt hoped something would come, but I did quite deliberately.
And you hoped something would not.
I was clear that something would not. And then she did, she didn't get married, but she married a well-known eternal composer called Volpe. Who remember there was a Schoenberg and Mr. Minor Way. Minor eternal composer and writer on music.
Yes.
Quite well known in his circles.
Yes.
W-O-L-P-E.
Yes.
Some sort of a German Jew.
Yes.
Austrian Jew. Went out of my life.
Yes.
She wrote multiple letters about saying Volpe was coming to England, could ever see him and so on. She didn't hold against me too much.
Yeah.
But at least she didn't get mad. I think she was rather less mad after than before. But I suddenly realized I was a prey to lunatics. The only people who...
What did you think? Did they want to mother you as I?
No, I think they wanted to be to get a bed with me, probably, or they thought so.
Yeah.
They wanted to have some bad, absolute bad. No, no. It was not the slightest element of...
Yes.
No, they weren't sorry for me, didn't do things for me.
Right.
They didn't...
They adored send you.
Me, they didn't send me coffees, didn't take me out, they didn't try and work for me or help me in any way.
Yeah.
Well, I think they had sort of abnormal passions for me. It came from something abnormal in their natures. No sane person ever developed this to this degree. Everything else which happened, these began with me.
But you sound as if you're saying
not
that,
with them.
That anybody, any woman who comes at you with a strong passion for you must therefore be abnormal.
Well, up to a point I had a certain reason for generalizing. From experience. I admit two instances. It's not, but still it's more than most.
Yes. Yes.
Not very many people have fallen in love with in some rather abnormal way. We're two lunatics, one by one.
Yeah.
As you said, that I had assumed that in many people who could possibly feel these feelings must be slightly mad.
Yes. Now then later on, I know we're getting ahead of ourselves, but there is a woman in Boston, in Cambridge, Mass.
Exactly the same. very good example. There was a woman at Harvard. She was a lecturer in Czech literature.
Yes.
Exactly the same happened.
Ah.
She was called friend of Jakobson, the eminent Jakobson. And she became my lecturer at Harvard. Developed on Russian thought. Yes. Developed similar emotions. And suddenly told Jakobson and his wife all about it. Jakobson's wife is a Czech. Then, second wife. Now what is her name? Součková.
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 First name?
No, I can't remember. Yeah. She again began writing me letters. Like the loony kind. Yeah. Rather hysterical letters saying that the world was consisted of mirrors, because everything she thought, felt, and so on was entirely real. So it became from me and came back towards me, and that I'm a seer, that I'm with me, and so on and so on. Letters of passionate adoration. Again, I had to avoid this. All I know is, Jakobson said, what is she lecturing about now? Oh, she said, yes. He said, pensively, along the Czech novel. You know, there's a Czech novelist she's interested in. He's wrote 110 novels, none of them any good whatever.
Bad sign.
Bad sign, yes. I didn't know there was a Czech novelist. 110 is quite a lot.
Yeah.
Not one of any many to know. Anyway.
But somewhere in this period, there
that's
is a
third lunatic.
There is
another. No, something happened before that. No. That already, we're running ahead because that's 1949.
Ah. I thought it was during the war.
No. I wasn't at Harvard during the war.
Ah.
Yeah. Oh, yes. There was somebody. I was in Harvard who lived in Cambridge,
yes.
No, but before we come to that, I think we must go a little earlier. In 1941, I went to the United States. I've told you the story of Guy Burgess.
Yes.
I went legally this time, so to speak. I went to normal little job in New York. And because I had a friend called John Foster, now deceased, he got me a seat, cabin, in an American export line boat from Lisbon, which was simply safer than going by a British boat at that time.
Yes.
Which I was quite happy to take. I flew to Lisbon, got into this boat, and on the boat, saw a lady by whom I was madly attracted. I didn't know her name, who she was, or anything about her. All I knew was that I was at the captain's table, because I was an official. Three tables away was this lady, was another lady and a man, and I couldn't take my eyes off. I was deeply affected. Probably for the first time to this degree. I'm trying to think if I'm telling you the truth. Was there anybody before that in Oxford? Yes, there was. Shall I interrupt myself?
Yes.
I was not very much in love, but I was attracted by a girl whom everyone was attracted by. The sort of, Huguenes, I think, is alive. She was a girl called, she was very, she was a belle. I mean, she was of everybody's taste. She was called Sally Graves, and she was a niece of Robert Graves, and daughter of a man called journalist on the Times, who was called Graves Superior, which is a joke, was Graf Superior, who refuted the famous blood libel on the Jews. That is a great achievement, the pages of the Times in his day.
What did he do?
The famous thing.
He referred to it.
No. There was a famous charge against the Jews from the Middle Ages onwards.
Yes.
That they kill Christian children to use our blood as a Passover.
Yes.
This was renewed in the 20s.
Yes.
In Germany and somewhere else in Czechoslovakia. And this man went into it and wrote a series of leading articles in the Times, which knocked them out for good. That was the classical refutation based on carefully examined evidence. It comes from the, I'm sorry, it's not the blood libel. I'm confusing, I'm in a bad state. I'm talking about Elders of Zion.
Yes,
that he knocked out, protocols, he knocked that out.
Yeah.
By his careful research. It was all written, as you know.
The protocols are written. A forgery.
It wasn't a forgery, quite. Yes, near it. It was originally in French, written by a man in the 60s in Paris. It's an imaginary dialogue between Machiavelli and Montesquieu, directed against Napoleon III, meant to be against the regime of Napoleon III. It was a kind of parody of some sort,
yes.
Meant to be a political pamphlet against the Second Empire. Yes. This fell into the hands of some Russian called Nilus. Some wonder why, how Russian came to call Nilus, I can't tell you what he wrote under that name. He translated and changed it. In that sense, the forgery. But it's based on this other thing in French, it's nothing, it doesn't do with the Jews.
Oh.
It's nothing.
Right.
You see, that's its origin.
Right. Yeah.
Then it was printed and spread, and yeah. The Tsar believed it, and everybody yeah. believed it, and the Arabs still believe it. It yeah. can be bought, both in the White Russian Church in Paris and in Cairo.
Yes. Those great centers of enlightenment.
Yeah. It's a very well-known thing, the protocols. They were, I think, by them in, I think, Pamet. Some copies.
Oh yes, I'm sure.
It's absolutely regular. It's a classical text.
Yes.
It'll never be completely eliminated. It's a wonderful thought to build a lot of Zaire. I think there are some by now, but weren't then. But anyway,
Graves.
Well, his daughter, was an undergraduate from Oxford, Sally, who then married him and got children. And we compared to Lady Margaret Hall in Oxford, in due course. She was a very attractive girl. And she had affairs with everybody. I think she was, so to speak, very affectionate.
Yeah.
She had an affair with Frédéric, she had an affair with Goran Maurice, she had an affair with a loud number of my friends. I felt very, very strongly drawn towards her, but never did anything. And she certainly, she was a friend of mine, and perfectly agreeable, and we used to have lunch together, and we remained friends, so to speak, up to a point. But then, it was very plain to me, which regarded me as hideously ugly, dreadfully unattractive.
Yeah.
That was plain. That was humiliating me.
Yeah.
And, but that was quite late in life. That's about 1936.
Yeah.
By that time I'd come to the conclusion independently.
Yeah.
And that was the occasion Stephen Spender's first marriage. So that's another story.
But Sally
Graves. She became called Sally Chilver.
Right.
She married a civil servant called Chilva, with whom she trompeted right and left, I think.
Yeah.
And then she became head of, became an anthropologist, knew about Africa, became head of Lady Margaret Hall. He's now retired.
Right.
So I know if she's alive, I'm not sure she is alive.
Yeah.
If she's alive, she must be in her 70s, you know.
Yeah.
The middle 70s.
Yeah.
Now, think, maybe late British 70s. She might be 75, 6.
Yes. I want to get back to this boat in.
By the time she came back to Oxford, I didn't have one bubble of feeling for her.
Yeah.
Again, same thing happened.
Yeah.
When I met her then, you see,
yeah.
It was well after the war. I must have met her. Virginia Woolf was very fascinated by her.
Yeah.
The lesbian sort of way.
Yeah.
And she took me to see Virginia Woolf. That's how I came to meet her. Virginia Woolf was very innocent in a sense. She used to ask her nieces, is there much free love these days? Well, Sally Travis was stuck as a perfect modern young woman.
Yeah.
She was totally fascinated by her.
Yeah.
So I was taken to dinner by her,
in
1937.
Right. And what were your impressions? Where did you go to dinner?
In the Wolf's house.
In? Yes.
Oh, well, that's I can tell you about that in parentheses.
Yes, we've now opened a parenthesis within a parenthesis. I'll have to come back. But
look, do we stop there? I go back to my love life. But I think we better...
Let's come back to your love life, and then I will
ask
you
come back to literary life in the 30s.
Yes, later.
Whom I knew, and who I read, and
yeah.
That sort of thing. That's a separate subject. All right, back to love life. Well, now, with Graves, it was all too hard. Then I'm in a boat, proceeding to America,
yeah.
The Excambion,
yeah.
That might mean.
Yeah.
And there's this lady whom I think is wonderful, with a small child. And two other, and this here, and another couple at the same table.
Yes.
That trip took 10 days to get to New York. It stopped in Bermuda for a day or two while it was being examined by British officials. All kinds of things happened to it. During that whole period, it wasn't big, the boat. I mean, it had 180 people on it. Everybody talked to everybody, more or less. I talked to a large number of people. They talked never to her, or she to me. Nor did she, when I remember that later, remember me on the boat.
Yeah.
the climax is coming. Then, the next time I met her was in the summer of 41, when I knew a man called Saint-Jean, who was a French journalist, who was a French correspondent of some, presumed by that time, Gaulle's paper, who was the lover of Julian Green, the writer. And we made friends somehow. And he took me to lunch with Robert de Rothschild, who was one of the Paris Rothschilds, who was living on Long Island in some fairly palatial house. And I was supposed to know about American affairs, which is why the Rothschilds always like asking experts to meals. And so I went along as a kind of bogus expert for a very hot summer's day. And there I met two ladies. One of whom was Robert's daughter, who was called Cécile.
Still alive.
What?
Cécile de Rothschild.
Yes. Who's still alive is Robert. She's in a very bad state now, but she still lives alone in Paris, in Switzerland, I can't remember where. And there was another lady. The other lady was the one I perceived in the boat. They took one look at me, and within 2 minutes were gone. Break off. I've never been fled from quite so fast. That confirmed my opinion of myself. Wait. Right, that was the second meeting. Then, I'm telling the story because it has a climax which you can anticipate. The third occasion which I met her was when my friend, Lord Rothschild, who was an MI5, as you know, came to America to see J. Edgar Hoover. And because we sent a secret message, the fact he was in the Pierre Hotel, would love to see me, so I went along. We chatted namely about what was going on. This would have been actually about September 41, so maybe even 42. When there was a dead knock at the door and the same lady came in. And I could see that their relation was so intimate, they knew each other so well, that I was de trop. So after 10 minutes I left. Yeah. That was my third meeting. After that, some years passed, during which I fell in love with somebody else, who I'm about to tell you about. No, you did properly fall in love. The next time I met her, just to complete the story, was in 1946, when my friend Victor Rothschild reappeared in New York after the war. I was winding up things, my job at the embassy. I was in New York for a time, I don't know why, came for a weekend or something. And I was staying with a well-known millionaire, Mrs. Otto Kahn. My friend Lord Rothschild said, there's a man called Dr. Halban, Hans Halban, an eminent nuclear physicist. Now you see what we're tending towards. He's coming to Oxford because Lord Charles has invited him. He's married to a great friend of mine. Would you be nice to them when they come to Oxford? I said, yes, I said, of course, yes. Would you like to come and have tea with them? Well, I knew the flat in which we were living, because I was talking about somebody called Alix de Rothschild, who was the wife of a man called Guy de Rothschild, who was the present head of the family. It was identical to that. There was the lady I'd met. And when I met her originally, she seemed to be cold, arrogant, detached, standoffish. I couldn't speak to her at all. By this time, she was gentle, soft, expecting a child, but obviously beaten down by her husband. It was very clear that something had happened. She had become a victim of some sort. Not a sign of pride and arrogance, on the contrary, gentle and sweet. And that was Aline, yes. It is hardly to do. And then they came to Oxford, and then I did ask them to lunch. After that, second chapter begins, I don't know about till now.
No.
That comes later.
Terribly
the story of my courtship and marriage.
Yes, I don't know, yes. I think we should defer that.
All right, but I just want to tell you chronologically.
Yes.
This is a case of my falling in love with somebody at first sight.
Yes.
Who hadn't remembered meeting me at all, or seeing me.
Yes.
No notice of me was taken at all, which confirmed everything I ever believed about myself in that regard.
But also must have confirmed you in the persistence of your own feelings.
No, because, I mean, it just happened. I didn't examine, not a self-examiner.
Yeah.
I didn't examine my feelings. I don't think about myself very much.
Yeah.
I'm very unintrospective. Yeah. I didn't ask myself, am I the kind of person who falls in love? What happens to me? Is this emotion common to me?
Yes.
And so on. How curious, I have this emotion again. I did last 4 years ago. What does it lead to? Nothing of this sort occurs in my life. I don't I don't examine myself in any degree, less than anybody who knows. I'm very, very mixed up in that sense. You see? And when it happens, I notice it. But it, I don't go through elaborate acts of self-examination and self-analysis in order to discover, in order to acquire self-knowledge of some kind. I've never sought self-knowledge. I have quite a lot of it, I think. But it came, by experience rather than by inquiry or self-examination. Or even by misfortune. Now,
would you like to continue this? It's it's a difficult story, but also a happy one. Perhaps you'd like to continue.
No, just if you like.
I have a feeling you did fall in love before that, and it would be good to talk about that story.
No, because I fell in love after that. You see, I fell in love with her on the boat in 41. It led to no consequences except much later. But that's the first time when I suddenly felt wildly attracted by somebody. I was quite attracted by Sally Graves, but not to that degree. She was very, very sexy, Sally Graves. So it is difficult for anyone in her presence not to feel, because she was very, was somewhat provocative in her manner. And as I say, was a very easygoing lady with plenty of lovers of various kinds. But then what happened was that in 1942, I don't know about the year, right? I had a great friend in Washington called Anthony Rumbold, Sir Anthony Rumbold Butt, who was a second secretary of the British Embassy. At that time, married a very pretty wife, who I also found attractive, but not to any marked degree. But still I did. I was mildly in love with her too. And I went to lunch, I stayed with them. And they said, tomorrow we're going to lunch with or dinner with somebody with Virginia Bulk. Virginia was the daughter of Michael Lord Brand, with my colleague at All Souls, part of this sort of kindergarten, middle of kindergarten. Married to Michael Bulk, who was the direct descendant of President Bulk. In the United States, not one of the better known presidents. Still, I'm not sure that many of his destiny didn't happen.
The
other thing, Mexican War. Mexican War.
Yes.
Well, I didn't know. And you'll meet someone called Countess de Bendon there. I imagine Countess de Bendon is a middle-aged Central European sort of adventuress.
Yeah.
Whom they happen to know. Probably another snobbish lady of absurd kind. Well, we went, I found someone sitting next to wildly attractive English girl, who was indeed called that.
Virginia Polk.
No, Virginia Polk was my hostess.
Yes.
The girl was called Countess de Bendon.
De Bendon.
Countess Patricia de Bendon.
Ah.
Why she called de Bendon, I will tell you in a moment. But she was obviously not foreign, not Central European, very young, and extremely agreeable.
Yeah.
And she, we talked. We made great friends, and I suppose she must have flirted a bit, and I thought I'd tell her to be attractive. And I asked who she was, and she's called Patricia Douglas. She was a great niece of Alfred Douglas, who married a daughter, her father was Lord
Queensbury.
What? What is the Douglas name?
Queensbury.
Queensbury.
Yes, Queensbury.
Quite right. She was daughter of Lord Queensbury, and is an actress. We married the result of after the quite right. That's right. And she was called Lady Patricia de Bendon. And she married a man called de Bendon, who is the son of a man called Count de Forest. I have to go back for a second just because it's so funny. Once upon a time, there was a Jewish millionaire called Baron Hirsch, who sent a lot of Jews to Argentina.
Yes. And to Northern Canada as well.
Canada, no doubt, who was sort of a philanthropist. He built railways, he's not a strong Hungarian Jew, built railways in the Balkans. I think the railways wound like this. So as he was paid by the yard,
they wandered around.
He became extremely rich.
Yeah.
And he came to England. I didn't think he was received at court in Vienna. But he did become a friend of King Edward VII.
Yeah.
And when he had a child, I suspect legitimate. I can't prove it to you. Because he was called Hirsch, King Edward was his godfather, suggested he might be called, persuaded Francis Joseph to give him a title. And he was called Baron de Forest, because that's where you found Hirsch was running about. Baron de Forest was half English, I mean, yeah. Mistress of the wife is English, but half Austrian-Jewish, yeah. And became inherited. And the old man was very eccentric and became Member of Parliament in England. And subsequently departed, lived in Switzerland, had a little flat built for himself among the branches of trees so he could listen to birds more conveniently, and became Minister of Finance to the Grand Duke of Liechtenstein, who conferred upon him the title von zu Benden, which is minute village. Yeah. Little Liechtenstein, as you know, but there's 50,000 inhabitants. Yeah. There is a village called Benden,
yeah.
Somewhere near Vaduz.
B-E-N-D-E-R-N?
Precisely. Von und zu. So he became called Count de Benden. Yeah. His two sons are also called Counts de Benden. My man was brought up in England, I don't know if he went to Eton, but he might probably did. Member of White's Club, I mean. Yeah. And he was a volunteer of the British Army, which he didn't need to be because he was Liechtenstein Count, and was taken prisoner by the Italians, and so on. And he married this girl. Very good looking, he, and sweet and innocent.
Yeah.
A sort of silly man, like somebody in Peter Woodhouse.
Yeah.
Absolutely disarming. Yeah. Still about. Yeah. Came to see us not so long ago.
Yeah.
Married various other wives in between. She was an evacuated wife. She was sent to America because wives were, and forged a certificate from school, which got her into Radcliffe College at Harvard, only by forgery. And
did she confess to this?
No, to me, yes, but not to them, ever. And then she was at Radcliffe, which had a large flat apartment, no house, I think, in Cambridge, Mass. And because she was called Lady Patricia de Benden, which was her title in English-speaking countries, she didn't call herself Grafin. Lady Patricia de Benden was correct. In English terms, professors in Harvard are actually snobbish. Mm-hmm. Everyone came to her dinner table. Yeah. Anyone she wanted.
Yeah.
She was 20, and what was I? In 1941, I was 42, I was 33.
Yeah.
No, 31.
Yeah.
She was 22, perhaps.
Yeah.
21, 22. And she was exactly 10 years younger than me.
That's
right. And, we made friends, and but she was a famous femme fatale.
Yeah.
You see what I mean?
Yeah.
You were a friend of the right and left.
Yeah.
It wasn't uncool, I know.
Yeah.
She was very beautiful. Not pretty, but
what
beautiful.
What was beautiful about her?
She was small, thin, had an exquisite face, and strong personality, and natural aesthetic taste, and the greater than anyone I ever met. She wasn't at all tutored. She was an extreme liar. Total, I mean, mythomaniac of the first order.
Yeah.
Not a word is true. I mean, she invented right and left. And I was treated very badly. What?
Yeah. And you were treated badly.
I was treated badly, yes. About 21 years, certainly I was. And she was, but she liked dons, she liked intellectuals. That's the point, for some reason.
Yeah.
Was drawn to them. And those sort of people. I'll tell you her story in a moment. And I asked her why she married Benden. She said, well, in the London Society for a time, everyone was so awful. All these smart people, who she genuinely disliked. She was never a natural member of London Society. She was a natural outsider. That she was. She had some kind of independent taste of her own. And he was gentle, he was sweet and pure and kind and spontaneous, nice character. So that's why she had married, quite good looking. That's why she got married to. However, at Harvard, she probably conducted affairs with various handsome Greek students whom she met on the side, anybody and anybody. By the time I met her, and boy, I didn't meet her that once, she came back to Washington. Again, I must have met her at some party. She knew people. She obviously knew the titled persons. She had some degree of acquaintance. At a certain point, I realized that I was deeply in love. And then she invited me to stay. Cambridge, Mass., to which I went, I remember very well the first dinner party. I met the man who wrote the classical book of that period of William James, called Ralph Barton Petty, very well known Harvard philosopher, head of Bundles of Britain. And his wife, I met a man called W.G. Constable, who kept, an Englishman who kept paintings in Boston Arts, Fine Arts Museum. And his wife became a lifelong friend of mine. They both did. Olivia Constable. I met a man called Ted Spencer, who was a famous professor of English, Harvard at the time, who died soon afterwards, and one of the other people. She gave a smart Harvard dinner party. In effect, what it came to. I stayed then 2 nights with Anne Wigerton, marvelously. And I found her conversation deeply fascinating, not just looks.
Yes.
However, nothing happened. Yes. Nothing ever happened physically. Yes. And because I think she found me just as unattractive as everybody else.
Yes.
But she clung to me. For some reason, she wished to keep me.
Yes.
And she wrote me letters, telephoned me, and she came to, used to come and see me at in Washington, and became known. I was in love with her. It was, as it were, notorious that I did find her very attractive. And so did other people. I mean, this wasn't. She was famous, femme fatale. People were tended to find her irresistible,
so
to speak. But I was barely treated because I was genuinely in love. From time to time, she would make appointments that she would break. She would tell me that, encourage me to go on saying that perhaps not now, but some later stage. Nothing she'd like more to be married to me. And then I heard that she was having a furious love affair with X, Y, and Z.
Yeah.
So I suffered.
Yeah.
Bangs of jealousy.
Yeah.
Of an absolute classical kind.
Yeah.
Straightforward jealousy, that was the way to imagine. This went on in 43. And in 44. And then she went back to England. Because her husband, by this time, had got out of his camp in Switzerland. Was exchanged for some sort of prisoners of war.
Yeah.
And she then sent me a telegram saying that I was to come to England once because of an affair. Her marriage was supposed to be the last, and she was mine, roughly. I just had the good sense not to come to England. And met her again in 45, I think.
Yeah.
I did come back and stayed with her and so on and continued to be in love with her. But it was absolutely clear that I wasn't going to marry her. By this time, she was quite prepared to marry me.
Yeah.
She was, so to speak, not doing anything else. She wasn't in love with me